broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. This is UBC Happy Hour, a show that is all about what's happening on UBC's campus, produced by the UBC Affairs Collective. If you like what you hear and you want to help, send us an email to ubcaffairs@citr.ca. I'm Lalaine.
I'm Amy.
I'm Alex, the coordinator for the collective.
I'm Jennifer.
I'm Sadie.
And welcome to the show, everyone. So today we have a lot happening. We're like seven people in the booth. So yeah, it's really a party right now. Happy Friday. So we're starting off the show with two special guests from the UBC, which is UBC's on-campus newspaper. We've had guests from the UBC on before. We had Sam McCabe on before when we talked about the Alma Stati trial. We had Emma Hicks, who's the blog editor, on before. And now we have two more. So you guys are kind of like infiltrating CITR. This is exciting. So we're joined by Jack Howen.
Hello.
Who is the coordinating editor at the UBC. And Fez Vogue. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Yay! we went over this before the show. And you're a contributor to the UBC.
Yes, I am.
Awesome. Yeah. So we're going to start off. So basically the UBC just won 3 journalism awards. So congratulations.
Thank you.
So Jack, do you want to kind of just quickly go over the awards you guys won?
Yeah, so we picked up 3 Johnnies or JHM awards. John H. McDonald at NASH, which is the Canadian University Press's annual conference. So all of the student papers in Canada all get together and talk about how great we are. We picked up 3, one for best social media, one for best investigative story for our probing into UBCO's student union and some shady stuff going on there. And then I won for best cover for a shot of AMS president-elect Alan Aaron Holtz getting a jug of beer dumped on him after he won.
Nice. I love that photo. It's really good. So the UBCO story, that one was really interesting. It's quite a long read, and it reveals kind of a lot of corruption. I think I was actually thinking reading it would make a great documentary or like podcast. I think there would be some really interesting like ways of approaching that story. But yeah, it was like very dramatic. So do you want to kind of give us like a little bit more detail about that?
Sure. So yeah, so that was written by Emma Partridge and David Nixon, who both worked at The Phoenix, which is UBCO student paper. And it's been kind of an open secret or whispered about or talked about for a long time that, for a few years, that there was some shady financial stuff going on. UBC-SUO, the student union up there, ran back-to-back huge deficits, like hundreds of thousands of dollars in deficits, which were unprecedented a couple years back. And people started looking into it and found that the president of the UBC-SUO, Rocky Kim, was running the SUO and also Class Media, which is like a magazine that does a lot of paid partnerships for advertising with local businesses in the area. And there was also a connection with him and the president who succeeded him, Tom McCauley, and this program called the Campus Community Bridge, which was set up to set students up with job opportunities, kind of like a co-op thing. So that was funded for, I think, $56,000. And a lot of that money ended up going unused. So the majority of that money, a strong majority, ended up going unused, and we still don't know where that went. So it's a lot of missing money and a lot of accusations of financial impropriety and conflict of interest, a lot of people who are angry and unwilling to talk. But thankfully, we had 2 amazing reporters who knew the issues in depth and were able to chip away at this thing for months and months and months and put together, like you said, a long, dramatic story outlining the past couple of years.
Did anything change as a result of the story?
The managing director, I think that's his title, the equivalent of Keith Hester here, but for UBC-SUO, Bob Drunkemall was let go after the story. And he was also heavily involved in this and was quite combative in the interviews that we did manage to get And eventually told us to stop contacting him in maybe not nice. So nice words.
Nice.
So he was let go after that. We don't know that it was a direct result, but the timing lines up.
Yeah, yeah. And then Emma's your girlfriend.
Yeah, so yeah. Full disclosure, yeah, I'm dating Emma, so a bit of a personal connection as well.
Well, that must have been a great night. Like, you guys both won awards. Like,
yeah. It was good. Yeah, she was in Vancouver. She didn't make it to Toronto for the conference, but it was nice. I was texting her immediately afterwards, and she was following along on Twitter.
Cool. Yeah, was the like event fun? I don't know. Was it cool to like connect with other kind of campus like journalism networks?
Yeah, it was awesome. It was meeting a lot of Twitter mutuals. Since it
Twitter
was in
mutuals,
Toronto,
that's such a formal term. I've never heard that before.
Since it was in Toronto, they were able to get a lot of awesome speakers. So a lot of journalists that I really look up to, I got to see workshops on. They had back-to-back keynotes from Robin Doolittle, who reported on Rob Ford and probably brought him down, and did the Unfounded investigation for the Globe and Mail more recently. And then the next day was Desmond Cole, who has done a ton of activism and journalism. And it was amazing. We were nerding out the whole time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So moving on to another story that appeared in the UBC this week, which was written by Fez. He's doing this like head bobbing thing that I really like.
I'm pretty excited.
So Fez, you wrote an article about the fall reading break, or the potential for a fall reading break at UBC. So do you want to just kind of give us a quick summary of the article?
Yeah, so basically I think every year the paper comes out with an article about why we don't have fall reading week. And this year I was lucky enough to pick up the pitch that our news editor sent out. So that's pretty much how I got the article. And it takes me about a week to write an article. But this one took me a month or so just because of the logistics of it. It didn't work out a little bit at the start, and then we had to contact different people. But ultimately it did, and now it's on the cover.
Yeah, so basically UBC, you know, for people who don't know, we don't have a fall reading break. We have one in February. But it seems as though a lot of other schools have a fall reading break. So that was one thing you mentioned. So how does UBC like compare to other
schools? While researching the article, for the article, I spoke to the head of undergraduate affairs for the psychology department. His name was Dr. Stephen Barnes. And he was telling me that 50 out of 70 Canadian universities that they surveyed had a fall reading week. So UBC was definitely in a minority in not having one. Forgot the question.
No, that's okay. Just, how does UBC compare to other schools? And so it seems as though, like, most other schools do have...
Yeah, we're definitely in the minority not having it. And it's become, like, a huge mental health issue at this point because, as Dr. Buns was saying, there was a lot of research that said that reading week generally has a positive effect on student mental health. But one interesting thing that he did point out was in schools that did have a reading week, the stress levels prior to the reading week commencing and right after the reading week were actually higher than in semesters that didn't have one. But at the end of reading week, when students looked back on it, they did have lower stress levels. And he said that was mainly because exams being centered around reading week, and that's why there was like a spike in stress levels. But overall, reading weeks are way better.
That's interesting, because I'm like, do I ever read on reading break? I don't think so. I think I normally, I don't know, bum around. I'm going to Mexico this year, so I'm definitely not going to be catching up on work. But I don't know, maybe I'm just speaking for myself. I'm sure there are others, you know, who do take advantage of that week to, catch up on school. Or at least, we need the time to de-stress. That might be the angle.
Yeah, I was just going to say that because, like, even if you're not actually studying during reading week, it probably just helps getting yourself collected. I mean, preparing for, like, the other half of the term and, like, all the assignments are due and things like that. So I guess that probably helps with, like, a lot of the stress. And plus, in the fall, when the weather is like super bad outside, it probably helps to like take a break from things when you don't have like papers to write constantly and midterms to give. So it's probably way better for your mental health.
Mm-hmm. And so you interviewed Kevin Doering. Am I pronouncing his last name?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it, but like, let's go with it.
Yeah, so he's a member, he's a student member of the UBC Senate. And one thing that I noticed a lot in his quotes that you used in the article was he was really kind of focused on this idea of like the economic value of the education. And so like, if students are paying this much for tuition, they should be able to kind of maximize teaching days and like how much, you know, learning they get out of it based on, you know, how much they're spending on the education. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting that it was like, it seemed like an economic prioritization for not having a fall reading break. Do you want to kind of comment on that?
Yeah, no, definitely. Or? Because so before I interviewed him for the article, I looked him up a little bit. And the pillars that he ran on for his post at Student Senate was, one of them was student affordability. And so I was the one that asked him the question, like, as to how he thought that would affect affordability. And he said that he wanted students to get the same amount of knowledge for a given cost. So he didn't hope, he hoped that a reading week being introduced wouldn't affect that sort of dynamic. And that was an interesting thing for me too, because I'd never thought about it from like an economic perspective before. But since that was one of his pillars and I did ask him that question, so that's how the answer came up. But I did think it was pretty interesting too.
Mm-hmm. I just find it interesting that every other university just extends, just has that week of, has the reading break, and they just extend it. So University of Toronto starts their exam period December 8th instead of December 1st. So I don't understand what UBC's problem is with just doing one more, you know, starting a little bit later, excuse me, and having exams on Sundays.
Yeah, so the way Kevin put it was, again, exams on Sundays was something that we did speak about. And he said that a lot of students, apparently they had done like a few surveys and things like that in researching the logistics of having a reading break. And he said that students did, in fact, prefer the Sunday breaks that they did get during the exam period. So that was one of the reasons they couldn't just take those away, because apparently those were like tiny stress relief periods during the final exam period, which in itself is pretty long and stressful. So that was one of the logistical things. But in terms of logistics in general, reading week is like a huge thing. Like the way we think about it is that students want it, like why don't we have it? But overall it does affect like the way the entire university runs. So if like instituting a reading week would have an effect on everyone from like custodial staff to like professors and faculty and things like that. So it's like a huge logistical change that needs to be accurately, you know, like put in place, if that's the correct way to word it. But
yeah, it's not as easy as just like snapping your fingers and then, you know.
I'm just wondering why we don't follow the format of other universities. Like if we're in the minority of it, like if everyone else has done it, I don't understand how UBC can't just follow that template.
So one of the things he did say was that UBC has the second lowest number of teaching days in Canada for any university, second only to University of Toronto. And again, he wanted students to get the adequate education for their money, but also there needs to be a minimum number of teaching days, apparently, as per UBC's rules and regulations. And right now, I think our first semester has 61 days, and if they needed to change that, it's a whole process. So in doing that, he has to, like in instituting a reading break, he has to take it, like they have to look at that aspect as well. So it's not just one piece of legislation, but rather multiples that have to work in sort of concert from what he tells me. So that's how it goes.
Yeah. Jack, did you want to comment on this or?
Sure. I was just thinking that the Sunday thing seemed a little weird since like nobody really, aside from a few exceptions, has like a full week of exams all day. Like when you're talking about Sundays being a small respite, like almost everyone has a Wednesday or a Thursday that's a respite. And even if they do have a full week of exams, they're not going to have two full weeks of exams. It just seems like a weird thing to like designate one day where nobody has exams when everybody has a couple days with no exams. But what you're talking about is totally correct, that it is a huge bureaucratic undertaking to institute a fall reading break. And we are already pushing up pretty close to Christmas at the for the end of exam period. Like, when did exams end this year?
I think it was like the 20th
or the 21st. 20th? Yeah.
So we don't have room to add another week. But I don't know. I think the main thing is that we're just not seeing the want or the drive to change it on the Senate and administrative level. There are a ton of challenges that need to be solved in order for this to be put in place, but it doesn't seem like anyone is really gung-ho on tackling them.
Which is an interesting point, but they're not the ones in exams right now.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we've heard from Santono that he supports the idea of a fall reading break, and obviously it's not his call, it's Senate's call, but we haven't heard anything past that. We haven't heard any, like, you know, action plan drafted from his office or like pressure actually put on Senate. It's just, this would be nice if it happened. And then mostly crickets from Senate, aside from interviews with student senators.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there are any schools who have implemented a fall reading break recently that, you know, UBC could kind of like look to as an example. If do you know of any? Or
So UBCO, I don't know if they did it recently or not, but UBCO does have like an extended Remembrance Day. So like the way I think about it, if there was any university to emulate, it would just be our sister school, because I would think that they have the most in common with us in terms of like the way their academic calendar is structured and things like that. Like I understand they have a different governing body that sees to all those things, but just them being our sister school should make it logistically easier to follow them in my mind. So
yeah, I'm surprised we don't kind of follow them already, but there's probably a reason for that.
Also, Queen's and the University of Manitoba just instituted theirs. Queen's was in 2017, and I think Manitoba was either that year or the year before. And those were shorter fall reading breaks, like those were two-day breaks. But, you know, it's a start.
Yeah, and when Jack and I were talking about this yesterday, like you made a really good point, which is that UBC is a massive school, and so there might be like different logistical issues that UBC could face that like a smaller school wouldn't necessarily face. So I think that was an interesting point. But yeah, it's definitely like a question. I mean, do you guys think we should have a fall reading break? Would you want one?
Personally, no. I wouldn't want to. I feel like the only way to get a reading break is to go backwards into the summer. Like, that's the only way to have enough teaching days. And I personally wouldn't want that because I like to not be in school when the weather's nice. And I don't know. For me, it wasn't that bad. Maybe I'll change my mind as I get older. But I know it's fine.
As I get older. You're like 40. You're like, I could use a reading break now.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm going to be in school forever. I've decided.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, when I think about, like, my time at UBC, I don't think I'm going to be like, man, like, I didn't have a fall reading break, like, never going back there, you know. But I think it's an interesting, like, discussion, and I think it's interesting to compare, like, UBC to other schools. And, I mean, I think that a little bit, like, I think maybe having the thing that UBCO has, like, an extra day onto Remembrance Day, like just having a 4-day weekend would be really nice, because then, you know, then you could go like on a little trip somewhere if you wanted to, or you would actually have time to like catch up on sleep, because I don't think the weekend is enough, and like I'm sure we all are already doing homework on weekends most of the time, so I think having like more time is necessary, but I don't know if it actually needs to be like a week long. Mm-hmm.
It would be a pretty easy PR win for them to institute an extra 2 days, 1 or 2 days, and call it a fall reading break. I mean, that's what we're seeing with bigger universities who are facing, you know, mounting pressure from their student bodies to institute one. And there's obviously the grumbles and groans that it's not a real fall reading break, but it's still something, and it can put the university on the track to considering it for the future. I thought it was a very good point about that you wouldn't want it to be pushed back into late August. Not only just because that's usually good weather time, but that presents a whole host of issues. Like we were talking about yesterday with international students and people who just aren't from Vancouver for finding housing. Mm-hmm. 'Cause either you have a friend or a place to crash for a couple days and attend school, or you're going to need to find a place for August instead of September 1st, which is just a whole nother logistic planning thing if you're moving across the country or across the world to come here.
Mm-hmm. this is like one small facet that I thought about in terms of like collective student health is that, I mean, I'm in first year and I know a lot of people on my floor were like so desperate to go home for 1 weekend because a lot of them missed Thanksgiving. And so I think in thinking of like mental health terms, like just having a 4-day weekend, like they get to go home, cry with their mom that they've been away for so long and then they come back. So like, I'm thinking like, yeah, again, I do feel the thing about like, I don't want to go back like August 31st, come to school. August 31st is a date, right? Yes. yeah, that's just my 2 cents.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, Fez and Jack, thank you so much both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, and so yeah, we're going to move on because we have more to cover on the show. But yeah, we're going to hear a song from Maze Theory. So they were actually just playing in the Nest today and as part of the AMS Live at Lunch events. And I really like them because they have a lot of variety. They do some like rapping, some like rock. And they participated in the AMS Last Band Standing last year. And they're all UBC students, so their names are Shannon and Lucas Otruba. I'm assuming they're siblings. Ryan Matheson and Nick Ponto. So we're going to hear their track, Silver Tongue.
As soon as it moves, Do you like laughing, hilarity, radical thought-provoking creativity, and laughing? UBC Improv is UBC's home for improvisational comedy, theater made up on the spot. Like us on Facebook to learn when our next shows are. Search for us on YouTube for our film sketches. And follow us on Twitter because we want the followers. UBC Improv. Insert cheesy slogan here. Let's get it on.
Something new or make your own clothes? We've got you covered. Here at the AMS Knitting and Sewing Club, we provide you lessons on knitting, crochet, and sewing, and a space to craft your own projects and meet with other people that share your passions. Like us on Facebook at AMS Knitting and Sewing Club.
Hi, everyone. You're back to the UBC Happy Hour on CITR. I'm Amy. I'm here with your weekly arts update. It's a bit of a short one today, but that's fine. So today, right after the show, UBC Improv is having our first show of 2018. I'm running over there after this. So doors open at 6:30, show at 7, $3 for tickets. Come see me. And also tonight, AMS is having Slow Magic, which is he's like a neon masked artist, so he's kind of like Daft Punk in the way that like doesn't take off his mask. I think that's cool. So he's performing at the Pit starting at 9.
Because I've seen ads for this.
Really? Okay.
I've seen so many ads for this.
I was like
who's that?
So his name is Slow Magic.
You don't know him because he always wears a mask.
Yeah, you wouldn't.
Wait,
you
know, is it like a Canadian? Wait, where is he from?
He's from the jungle.
We don't know. We'll never know because
he's from Mask World. We're like, what?
But yeah, he's at the Pit tonight at 9 p.m. And so if you want to buy tickets, it's $20. I think you have to go online to do that. So just go to AMS Events. So that's the events for today. And then we go all the way to January 17th. UBC Slam is having one of their shows at Benny's Bagels, and they're having a show with Brandon Witt, who is a Canadian slam poet. And this show, it's open to everyone, so Brandon Witt will perform, and then you'll have your own chance to perform on stage. So come around 6:45, sign up is at 7, and show starts at 7:30. And so,
with bagels?
With bagels, it's at Benny's Bagels.
Wait, what? I just heard bagels.
It's at Benny's Bagels, the slam show. So come there. I think you can probably get bagels.
Oh, yeah, there's bagels there.
Oh, there's
good bagels?
Super cheap beer, $4 a pint.
Nice.
Like good bagels? I love bagels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can go there, get some good beer, good bagels, and see some good slam poetry. And then January 18th, crowd playlist night at the Pit by the UBC EDM Club. And so... it's just a very chill night after Pit Night on Wednesdays. On Thursday night, you can come listen to some EDM. And they have this cool thing where if you use the app OutLoud, you can select the songs and play your own music with it. So that sounds really neat. And it's at 9 p.m. at the Pit. And then finally, on Friday, January 19th, next week, Rappers Without Borders is having a icebreaker. And so you just come there and... have a freestyle. It always sounds so cool. I could never do it.
Do it. Do it.
No.
No, do it.
One time, UBC Dive had a thing at Kerner's, and they had a bunch of arts people performing, and UBC Improv was first, and we did it, and it was okay. It was fine. And then Rappers Without Borders comes on, and they just, like, light up the stage. Everyone was, like, out of their seats, like, jamming, and for us, they're just giving us, like, polite applause. We're like, okay, cool, whatever. So if you wanted to go to the Rappers Without Borders icebreaker, it's, the 19th, 5 to 7 in room 2514 in the Nest. And rumor has it there might be an after party. Whoa.
Whoa.
Ooh. Whoa. Fun. Yeah, I'm always really into the freestyle, and I'm not really good at it either. So moving on to, so thanks for that, Amy. And you're in improv tonight.
Yes. Come check it out. It's going to be a really fun show. I don't know what everyone else has planned. I mean, we don't have anything planned because it's improv.
Ha ha.
So improvised there.
So moving on to a different topic. So Sadie interviewed a UBC researcher this week. Do you want to kind of maybe introduce this this interview?
Yeah, I sat down with a UBC researcher, Marlies, what was the name?
Hofer.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about her study that has gotten a lot of media attention about how your stress levels can be reduced by smelling your partner's shirt.
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy because, like, I mean, I just Googled it and, like, so many – I literally just Googled smelling your partner's shirt and, like, so many articles have come up. Like, Miami Herald, Jakarta Post. Jakarta picked up on the story.
Jakarta.
Yeah. Wow.
It's everywhere.
CTV Vancouver Island, LiveScience.com, Time Magazine was all over this as well. WebMD, Money-ish. I've never heard of them. Yeah, Money-ish. Pop Inquirer, like apparently Unilad, like that Facebook page that everyone's obsessed with, also picked up on it. Telegraph, like MSN.com. Who even knew MSN was still a thing?
MSNBC, yeah.
Yeah, so National Post, like so many different news organizations have kind of picked up on the story. So yeah, so Sadie interviewed Marlies, who, you know, did this research, and I think it's interesting because we asked her about why she thinks this study in particular got so much attention. So yeah, so let's hear that.
Hi, I'm Sadie, and today we're joined by Marlies Hofer to talk about her study.
Hi, Sadie. Thanks for having me.
So to start off with, for our listeners, can you briefly explain your study and the results?
Sure, I'd love to. So we brought in about 100 couples to UBC Lab. It's the social health lab here. We had men serve as the scent donors, and so by that I mean they provided scents. They did that by wearing a t-shirt we gave them for 24 hours, and while they were wearing that shirt, they refrained from certain activities that could affect their body odor, so that's things like using deodorant or scented body products. And then the women were brought into the lab, and they were assigned to one of three conditions, and this was a random assignment. They didn't know what condition they were in. And they either smelled a shirt of their partner, or they smelled a shirt that was worn by a stranger to them, or they smelled an unworn shirt. And after that, they underwent a stress test that involved a mock interview. They had to sort of come up with a job that they really wanted to have and tell us why they were the best candidate for that job, and then go through some questions. After that, they went through a mental math task, and this was all in front of two judges. They were wearing white coats, and we had cameras recording them, and this test altogether is called the Trier Social Stress Test, and it's a well-validated test to induce mild to moderate levels of stress. So throughout that entire procedure, we monitored women's stress levels, and so the goal of the study was to compare people who were exposed to their partner's shirt to the other two conditions, the stranger's shirt and the unworn shirt. And our findings were that women who smelled their partner's shirt experience lower stress, at least perceived stress, compared to those other conditions.
That's all very interesting. So why did you choose to only test women smelling their male partner's shirt?
That's a great question. We chose to look at women specifically just for methodological reasons. Specifically, the biggest one was that women are known to have a better sense of smell on average than men. So we just wanted to give ourselves the best chance of finding this result if it was in fact there, but we would love to see this study done on men and other types of relationships, that sort of thing, in the future.
Yeah. So what do you think are the potential applications of this research, if any?
So one of the applications would be that with globalization, people are increasingly traveling for work, and they're moving more to new cities. So this research would suggest that something as simple as having an article of clothing worn by a loved one could help lower stress when you're far from home.
Oh, that's, I didn't really think of that, but that's really interesting. And
Thanks. So I
also saw that, like, when people smell the stranger's shirt, their stress increased.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, even kind of...
Well, it's actually specifically their cortisol levels increased.
Okay, and that's a marker of stress.
It's a marker. It's a physiological stress marker, exactly.
Right. Yeah, because I was thinking, like, I was just, you know, on the bus this morning, and it was, like, super crammed, and I'm, like, sitting next to so many people, and I was like, I wonder if maybe, like, scent has anything to do with that, or, you know, I thought that that was kind of an interesting, like, finding, and I saw that that was kind of something that surprised you. Like, was that something you weren't expecting, or?
Well, in the beginning, we came into the study interested in how partner scent could reduce stress levels, and I guess we weren't exactly looking for an effect of the stranger scent, but in hindsight, it does make sense that, and we do know that humans from an early age are, they fear strangers, so even a cue as subtle as an olfactory cue might activate the fight or flight response in humans and lead to that higher cortisol level that we observed.
Yeah, I remember in my Psych 101 class, the only psychology class I've ever taken, but it was really interesting, and I remember reading that, like, scent is the most powerful sense for memory.
Right, it has been linked to memory quite strongly.
Yeah, maybe that's just what my textbook said, but yeah, maybe that's, like, related, but yeah, I thought that that was, like, maybe an interesting, like, marker as well.
Yeah, in general, scent has not been studied as much as other forms of communication, like visual or auditory communication. We don't know nearly as much about how we communicate through scent. So there's a lot of open questions, and that's one of the reasons that I chose to study this field, because I feel that there's a variety of really interesting research to be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this study has received a lot of media attention from many different outlets. Do you have any ideas about why this study specifically garnered so much attention?
I think that's a great question, because it's a question that I've been asking myself, too. I am not exactly sure why, but if I was to make a guess, it would be that potentially it's a very relatable topic. So I think that because often when I tell people about my research, they come back to me with stories about times that they've turned to scent for comfort in the past. And I think that they might not have consciously thought about why they were engaging in these behaviors, so it potentially just gets people thinking.
Yeah. When you mentioned earlier about people taking shirts or something when they travel, it kind of just reminds me of like when you're a child and you have a special doll or a blanket.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe I know that people get attached to a blanket or a doll, and maybe there is some scent cue associated with that. I never thought about that before. That's an interesting concept. I was thinking, actually, in the future about studying the first time that kids go to daycare and they're separated from their parents for the first time, if we could give them some sort of a doll or something that was infused with the scent of their parent and see if that helps with separation anxiety. So that would be along the same lines as what you're saying.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, yeah, further to kind of the relatability point, yeah, one of our contributors, Amy, like, we were talking about this study, and she was like, oh, well, I think that this is cool, and it probably, you know, got so much attention because it's something that, like, people can kind of, like, almost, like, test at home. And so, you know, it's not like some, you know, I don't know, super, like, abstract thing that, like, lay people, you know, kind of can't even conceive of. Like, it is very relatable, and yeah, and it's also kind of like a, you know, I feel like our news is so saturated with horrible stories that we're like, ah, yes, I do love the smell of my partner. Like, yes. Sadie, do you have anything else you want to ask, or
just one more question?
Sure.
So with all this media attention, do you think that the kind of reporting on your study is staying true to the results, or do you think that it may be getting misconstrued in any way?
Most of the reporting I've seen has been really good, but a lot of it's been when I spoke to one of the reporters and then they sent me a copy of their article after it was published, so they would have already spoken to me and gotten fairly accurate representation of the results. There's been a few that I've come across randomly that were not correct, that stated the results somewhat incorrectly. So one point that's a bit more nuanced is how women, after being exposed to their partner's shirt, how their cortisol levels responded. Our specific finding was that only in women who were both exposed to their partner's shirt and were able to accurately identify that scent, so they had a conscious awareness that they were exposed to their partner's shirt, those were the women who experienced a cortisol stress buffering effect. So I saw in some of the media outlets that that nuance was sort of overlooked, and people just said cortisol levels were lower. So that's one example where I've seen some misconstrued results. But in general, I haven't seen anything, I haven't seen overarchingly bad reporting on this study.
Well, yeah, now your research is, like, all over the news, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And, we look forward to more studies, maybe the one on children and their daycare.
I'm running that one. I'm also actually finishing up a study looking at sleep quality associated with either sleeping exposed to your partner's scent or not exposed to your partner's scent. So these are people sleeping alone for a night. And actually, a lot of UBC students are in it, so maybe some people are participants, but we're looking to see whether potentially being exposed to your partner's scent lowers or increases your sleep quality. And we are actually finding that at the moment, but the study is still ongoing.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
Okay.
That's super interesting.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. We won't take any more of your time. Good luck with your grant proposal and everything else.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Dance Horizons provides affordable classes and encourages students to get involved with the community to develop as dancers.
Our classes are open to all skill levels, with styles ranging from hip-hop to ballet, and are taught by professional instructors.
We're running some exciting events in the next week.
Our dancers will be visiting Harbor Dance Center and are putting on a show on campus on December 3rd. If you want to see us dance to this song, visit UBC Dance Horizons on YouTube.
What is CITR's reputation, being that it's been around for so long?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's very active in the community because it's run by community members and UBC students, obviously. Whether you're into radio as a hobby or whether you want to get some real-world experience, it's a great place to go. It's like a very open and creative environment. Everybody that's, you know, working here seems really jazzed about what they're doing at the station. Just lots of really, like, good, like, challenging music and spoken word content. It's a great station.
CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Vancouver, British Columbia, on unceded Coast Salish, Musqueam territory. Learn how to get involved at citr.ca.
Okay, so we're back on UBC Happy Hour. We're broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory here at CITR 101.9 FM. And we just heard Sadie Lai's interview with Marlies Hofer, who did this study on smelling your partner's shirt. And it got so much media attention. I think, Amy, you had made a really good point about the study, which is that it's like a relatable, piece of research. Like, it's something we can actually test out ourselves, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, something we talked about after the interview was how so many of kind of the research projects that go on here, especially in psych, are done by UBC students as the participants.
And like how that might like influence research. But I think that that's something that like a lot of studies like grapple with is like, when it's a lot of like student participants You know, how does that affect like the research, considering most of them are like younger and.
Yeah, and what it's like being a student in those surveys and what like that kind of experience is like.
Yeah, has anyone ever like participated in a research survey?
I haven't at UBC, but I did one at, I live in Kingston where Queen's University is, and I took part in the a sexual study where they wanted to find out the mind and body relationship in women. So I watched porn and I had to test with like a lie detector if I was turned on or not.
You're like, no. And they're like, lies.
They also had a vaginal piece that went inside to like test and it had electrodes in it to see if like I was actually lying or not.
Oh my god, that's so intense.
So was it like a lie detector, like the one that they put on your finger?
Yeah, it was the one on the finger, and then they have this piece that they built that like goes inside you, and it has electrodes on it to see like if it was firing. And I got paid $40, so.
First of all, that's like rad. That's so crazy. But like, what would be the point of the lie detector like on the finger? Because those don't like. I don't know. Those don't work so well. Especially, it's like more works for like high intensity stuff.
It was to see, it was the mind and body relationship.
Oh, that makes sense.
So if like you could watch something, but your like body's turned on, but then my mind could be like, oh, I don't find that. I'm not turned on.
That's really interesting. Wow. Do you know what the like findings like ultimately proved or? Did you read like the study afterwards or?
I don't remember. I just remember I was like, I feel weird. I just took my money and went.
You're like, best $40 I've ever made.
It was for science.
That's awesome. Yeah, I know that like the when you take a psychology class here, they part of your grade is like participating in studies. I don't know. Is anyone taking a psych class? And
actually, in my linguistics class, we can get like bonus marks if we go to a lecture or if we like a big linguistics lecture or take part in a linguistics study. So it's different from psychology, but like, yeah, I don't know. Like linguistics, I guess it'd be the same type of theory of like putting together like a theory and trying to prove it, but less to do with the mind and more just like probably like listening to me speak.
Also, like doing studies is so. A lot of times you can get a lot of like really odd responses. I ran a study my last year of high school where I collected dream samples from like a couple hundred people, and it was just a lot of them were really weird.
That's like, I would love to participate in that because I have such weird dreams and I write them down. Well, I can send you all of them.
I'd love that. If you keep a really like long, detailed dream diary for years, there are researchers out there who would really like to see that and really want that.
I want them to do a study because I've recently gotten like one of those like sage diffusers.
I have one of those. I'm obsessed.
Ever since I've been using it, I've only been using it for like a week, and this whole week my dreams have been like insane. And, like, my sleep has been very weird.
Your dreams can be triggered by olfactory senses.
And,
like, the dream production chain loop can be, like, it's all connected. So sometimes external stimuli can affect what you're dreaming. It's just kind of a similar process to when there's, like, a bright light but you don't wake up and then you see kind of a bright light in your dream. It could be triggering memories because, like, the study we just talked about. Smell is so tied to memory.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I'm just a science nerd sometimes. It's fine.
I always forget my dreams. I have really vivid dreams, but I always forget them, or I can't like have the description that would be necessary.
Well, that's why you have to like write them down like immediately, because apparently like the more like you write them down, the more you can like remember them. So
yeah. I guess I find like it would be like, oh, I was in my old house, but then I wouldn't have enough detail in there. Or it'd be like weird things like we were having a competition like on American Idol, and I was like, wait, what is that?
Yeah, I did a year long independent study on dreams, and there's like I can literally talk about it for hours. Mm-hmm. But just even the fact that, like, all of our listeners and us, even though we've talked about dreams today, there is a higher chance that we will all dream tonight and remember those dreams.
Mm.
It's that, like, kind of, like, conscious awareness of dreaming. Also, your dreams are really disjointed generally, and we don't necessarily know if that's, like, whether you have one singular dream or it's, like, you, after you wake up, piecing together what you just dreamed.
Mm. Has anyone ever had sleep paralysis?
No.
Is that when you, like, you're, like, half awake?
Yeah,
and, like,
yeah. So yeah. I had this, like, crazy experience. Like, I remember it so vividly where, so sleep paralysis is basically when your mind is, your body is asleep, but your mind is awake. So there's, like, this disconnect, and basically that, like, triggers the fight or flight senses that you have, because it's, like, imagine, like, you know, your body's awake, so it's thinking, like, oh my God, if someone attacked me or, like, if something happened, I wouldn't be able to, like, run away. So they're heightened. So anyway, basically, it usually happens when you're kind of, like, in between sleeps, or, like, because I think it's, like, you can't, maybe you would know more about it, Sadie, because you're a science nerd, but I guess it's, like, you don't reach, like, that, you don't reach, like, your full sleep cycle.
It can actually happen when you're coming out of REM or going into REM, and it has to do with the nodes that are on the back of your neck that control the paralysis when you're sleeping.
That was, like, the perfect answer. I was like, perfect. That's exactly what it is. Yeah, so it was so weird. So I was, like, basically, it was horrifying. Like, it's the most frightening thing I've ever experienced. Like, I thought the devil, like, I'm not religious. I don't really believe in, like, a devil, you know, figure. But, like, I literally, like, when I woke up, I was like, oh, my God, the devil was, like, in my room. And I was so scared and I couldn't do anything. And, like, when I finally woke up, like, I felt like I had never slept. Like, I was exhausted. And then I was and I had no clue, like, what had happened.
Because your mind's actually awake.
Wait, how long did it go on?
Well, so, okay. So when I looked at, like, the clock when I fell asleep, like, so I woke up from sleep and it was, like, about 5 a.m. And then I fell asleep shortly thereafter, and then it happened. And so that was probably, like, maybe, like, 5:15, 5:30. And then I think I woke up around, like, 9. So it felt like the full, you know, 3-4 hours, but it probably was like 10 seconds.
Yeah, time is really weird when you're asleep, like, really weird.
Yeah.
So it was really crazy. I don't wish it on anyone. And they made it, there was a documentary made about it. And, like, even seeing the ad, I was like, I can't watch this because this is, like, so horrifying.
Damn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So interesting. But okay, so in other news that's related to,
wait,
well,
what were we talking about?
Well, I guess I don't really know how we got to this topic.
The shirt.
Yeah,
the studies.
Yeah. So, but in other news, because Amy had been talking about linguistics, and so there was an article that appeared in the UBC this week that was written by Zach Vessera. And UBC is going to introduce the first universally accessible American Sign Language course. So, yeah, basically, so the course code is going to be LING447H. And the quote is, the LING447H has been designed as a pilot course to introduce the language on campus with the eventual goal of integrating sign languages into the curriculum of the linguistics department and UBC as a whole.
So is it starting next fall?
I believe so. Yeah.
So I could take it.
I think, yeah, you could take it.
I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Decided.
Sadie was really excited about this class.
I've always wanted to learn American Sign Language, like, always.
Well, and you were saying that, like, you don't, like in the arts program.
Yeah, in the arts program, you need a language requirement. And, like, for me personally, like, it's very difficult for me to learn a language. But I think if you can get excited about what you're learning, it's a lot easier to learn, and I know that I'd be excited about sign language. It's also so, like, physically, like, it becomes almost like riding a bike because it's so physical in some ways, you know?
Are you not excited to learn a language? Yeah, wait, why aren't you excited to learn?
I don't know. They just don't interest me as much for whatever reason. I know I tend to like things that I'm good at, and I tend not to
fair.
Be good at learning a language.
Yeah, like, learning language is hard.
It's really hard. I think I'd like it if I went to a place and learned it, but the idea of, like, writing, and that just, I don't know.
Yeah, I always like, I don't understand why they always teach us writing. I'm like, when am I ever going to write down directions if I'm in France? Like, we learn French in Canada, but like, am I going to be like, je suis tu es elle?
Yeah, no, I get the point that you're making, which is I think that if you're learning a language, like, merely to, or not, maybe not merely, but, you know, the main goal of your learning the language is to be able to, like, converse when you're traveling or when you're around people who are that, like, who speak that language, then I think just knowing, like, basic conversation is, you know, more important than all, like, the theory and stuff behind it. But they're obviously interconnected. But, you know, there's so many apps now for, like, learning languages and stuff like that in that way that, you know, it's, like, a university, like, Spanish class might not fill that, you know, need. But, yeah. But the sign language, I think, is really interesting. And it's also – yeah. And it's also because, you know, like, I remember when my – like, you see a lot of, like, little kids learning, you know, like, basic sign language skills.
Yeah, and they can learn it before other learning, like, actually to speak.
Yeah. And because I remember, like, my little cousins, like, would always, like, you know that thing where you're, I'm like, kind of cupping my hands and putting them together, and that means, like, more or something? That's really cute, you know?
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
And, like, you know, it's kind of interesting. So kids, like, obviously, you know, absorb all that. And,
yeah. There's, like, a parenting... well, my sister's due in February, and so there's, like, a parenting class you can take that's, you know, teaching your infant newborn how to speak and communicate, even though they don't have the, I guess, I don't know what I'm trying
like
to say.
Like, oratory skills or maybe,
like, with your mouth to say it, but they can move their hands and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very cool. Lalaine, would you take a sign language course?
Like, I'm really interested, but mostly because... I used to like watching those YouTube videos of monkeys and like gorillas doing sign language.
Oh. you're like I could talk to them.
Yeah, like, that'd be so. Yeah, maybe just for that reason.
Yeah, they just really like, they really can learn those languages.
It's so interesting.
Well, and that brings up a good point, which is that sign language is it's a universal language. Like, I always think that that's so cool that like deaf people, like, regardless of where. I believe, you know, regardless of where you are in the world, you speak the same language?
Or no, that's not true.
Really? Okay.
Actually, one of the earliest versions of sign language was in, like, indigenous peoples in North America because there was, like, a very common mutation that caused deafness. And so there were actually quite a number of sign languages before ASL.
okay so does anyone know if like that. Is it now, because this is American sign language, so
I want to say that there's other ones. I feel pretty confident saying that.
Okay that's really interesting. I guess I just kind of imagined that like it was, you know, all the same, but and I thought that was really like neat, but maybe not. That's like,
so is there like a German sign language and like an English sign language?
I don't know, but I think there's more than one. I think probably ASL is the most common.
Okay. Wow. Well, you'll be able to take it at UBC, pending.
I'm doing it. So if you want to be in class with me.
That'll be so cool. So we're going to kind of close up the show. We're going to listen to a song from Rebecca Hope, who is a First Nation singer-songwriter and guitarist. And she plays kind of like stripped down acoustic music, and she also studies English literature here at UBC, so pretty cool. Up next is Radio Pizza Party, and thank you all so much for listening to UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, and happy Friday, everyone. Happy Friday.
I just signed goodbye.
Awesome.
I love it.
Okay, we'll see you all, we'll hear you all next week.
Bye.
I was going to say
Darling, I've been waiting a long, long time. Just spit it out. 'Cause I've been hearing words from other people that ain't coming out your mouth. Take your heart. wish they could hear how foolish they sound.